Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Today's guest on Nature Bats Last is Dar Jamail, staff reporter at truthout.org. Dar's own website is darjamail.net. Today's show is a call-in show. US listeners can call in toll-free on 8888-74888. International listeners can call the studio directly on 01-605-562-5199. If you miss those numbers, they are posted on my dystopian Facebook wall. As a disclaimer, I'd like to state that Dar and I are personal friends, and I've had the pleasure of having Dar stay with me on Rakino Island. We toured some of the North Island of Aotearoa doing research together for his forthcoming latest ominously entitled book, The End of Ice. Dar, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Kevin. Great to be with you.
It's a pleasure to speak with you again. Why don't we start off in what I would refer to now as the boiling Arctic? As we speak, the Arctic is seeing temperatures above zero when it's cloaked in 24-hour darkness. There have been temperature anomalies of 20 degrees C above average. How can this not be deemed an emergency? For the coming melt season are incomprehensible as the prospect of a sea ice-free Arctic Ocean looms. Shall we start there, mate?
I think that's absolutely the best place to start because of the obvious, global implications. I mean, first, I think we should just pause for a moment on one of the things you just pointed out. If people can just envision the North Pole, the iconic North Pole, in the depths of winter, the sun doesn't shine for 1 minute of the day. It hasn't even risen yet for the first time through the depths of winter. So it's in total, utter darkness. And you're at the North Pole and you're seeing above freezing temperatures. I think if people just ponder that for a minute, you can start to understand how out of balance everything on this planet is, that something like that can happen, that should scare all of us. You know, I mean, you know, as a journalist sometimes, and certainly as scientists, people are very leery of being referred to as an alarmist. But when you're in a life and death situation, I think you're morally obliged to be an alarmist. And I actually have interviewed scientists that have said, I am officially sounding the alarm bell. And certainly those studying the Arctic, you can find several of those scientists now officially sounding the alarm bell. And this has been going on for years. You and I have been watching this and tracking this for years, but it has hit a new point this winter that is making even the most hardened of us at this point shake our heads.
Absolutely. One of the huge issues for me as we monitor the unraveling of the biosphere is scientific reticence. And I also think journalistic reticence as well. No one is prepared to put their hand up and point at the elephant in the room and the level of the emergency. In January 2015, you published an article titled The Methane Monster Roars, where you quoted Paul Beckwith saying, "It is my view that our climate system is in the early stages of abrupt climate change that unchecked will lead to a temperature rise of 5 to 6 degrees within a decade or two." Yesterday, I was sent the latest paper from that Andrew Glickson, a recent a guest of mine on the show. He sent me a paper titled "The Onset of Climate Tipping Points, Methane and the Future of the Biosphere." One quote in that paper is, "It is becoming clear the Earth is entering a period of uncontrollable climate tipping points." Can you extrapolate on that a little bit for me?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, as we just discussed, the evidence is right in front of our face, whether it's these almost science fiction level anomalies that are happening in the Arctic, that just happened in the Arctic, to record-breaking wildfire seasons across the U.S., to droughts, to these major rain anomalies like Hurricane Harvey that hit Texas this past summer, and several of the other hurricanes. I mean, all of which, you know, there's ample scientific studies linking them directly to climate disrupt, to human-caused climate disruption. And I think that when we talk about the fact that we are already in abrupt climate disruption, that is unarguable at this point. If you just look at the extreme weather events that are happening on a daily basis now, and, you know, I write my climate, my monthly climate disruption dispatch for Truth Out, and it's, you know, it every month I do it, I'm still blown away by how fast along we're moving. And so when we hear these predictions of, we could see a 5 to 6 C increase by, you know, within the next X number of years, whether it's 10 years or by 2035 or by 2050, as some of these predictions have been made, like the BP and Shell document that you pointed out, Kevin, a ways back, that was published in The Independent, or a story about it anyway, published in The Independent this last fall, talking about that they're basically preparing their shareholders to see a 5 to 6 C increase by 2050. You know, it used to be that these kinds of predictions, people were really, really blown away or thinking they're very, very outlandish. And a lot of the general public still might believe so. But I think that that's changing. And I think that they're becoming more believable now, when we're seeing this dramatic evidence in front of our faces every single day of what's happening around the planet, from record high temperatures to record wildfire seasons to this, you know, insane phenomena that's happening in the Arctic right now, to the rapidity of glacial loss around all of the planet. You know, the reality is that by 2100, and this is not me, this is, I always am just sharing information that I've gleaned from talking to experts for articles I write, or people that I've spoken with for my book research, that there will not be any more land terminating glaciers anywhere on the planet by 2100. I mean, think about what that means, and with water supplies, and, you know, how many billions of people are reliant upon water just from glacial melting alone. So what happens when you take away all those glaciers? What happens to humans' capacity to feed ourselves when there's 7.5 billion plus people on the planet? And so, again, is it alarmist to talk about this stuff? Because in reality, we're not being even alarmist. We're simply talking about what's actually happening.
Absolutely. I would like to actually talk about the 2100 meme and how that is used as a way to kick the can down the road. But we have a caller, everybody, and it's Professor Guy McPherson, the former host of the show. And so good for you to call in, Guy. How's it going?
Good. How you doing, mate?
I'm doing very well. I have two of my very best friends on the planet on the show. How cool is that? Guy, awesome. You have a trip or a tour coming up shortly. What's that about?
Yeah, I'm doing the East Bay Sierra Club dinner series again late in March and also late in April. It's a three-part series, and I'm unable to make the third part in May. But Jamin Shively, who invited me earlier to speak as part of this series, has organized this John Muir lecture series that is looks like it's going to be pretty dynamite, and we're still working out the details of how that's going to work out.
Well, cool. That's interesting that Sierra Club are opening the door to your perspective, because I find them extraordinarily conservative myself.
As do I, and I think this is an example of one person wearing the banner of the organization, willing to step outside of the conventional box. And I think that's wonderful. I don't think he has the approval of the Sierra Club at any level, but he's following in his father's footsteps as being the host for the East Bay Sierra Club dinners. So good for him.
Ah, very cool. Is there anything specific that you wanted to ask Dar?
Yeah, I want to ask both of you, actually. Dar Jamil, hello, by the way, and thanks so much for being Kevin's guest today.
Hi there,
and
guy.
Kevin, too, if you could both take on this question, there's no doubt in my mind that we're in the midst of a planetary emergency. It was, after all, a paper in the Annual Review of Earth and Planetary Sciences that projected an ice-free Arctic in 2016, plus or minus 3 years, and I would be stunned if that year didn't happen this time around, 2018. And an ice-free Arctic, of course, we haven't had with the species Homo sapiens on the planet. So are we in the midst of a planetary emergency? Yes, absolutely. Now, I have some ideas of my own about why nobody is declaring an emergency, even though I suspect most high-level, high-ranking politicians and CEOs are fully aware. But I'd like you to address that question. Why is nobody calling for a planetary emergency if, like us, there are surely other people who are in positions of greater influence than the three of us who know about this? So can you hit me with your answers on that?
I think that it's you know, as a journalist, it's always follow the money. So it's a situation of when you have global political leaders that are essentially all lobbyists for the corporate powers behind them, because I think in most countries around the globe now, that's the state of corruption of all the political systems. And so that being the case, I mean, I'll just use the U.S. as the most obvious and blatant example of all of them, that when, you know, you've literally got a clown as a president, and the people behind pulling all of his strings are clearly the fossil fuel industry, the NRA, and whatever other businesses of that are of and from the system that's essentially devouring the planet. If they're the ones pulling the financial strings, then it doesn't behoove said government to make any changes that will affect those profits of those companies. And so that's the short answer. And so, and then take iterations of that and apply it to different countries around the globe. And so that's why at best you see these kind of half measure lurches toward like the Paris Accords, a non-binding agreement that nobody's under any obligation to follow anyway. You know, just these kind of really paper mache facades of to make it look as though we're doing something. And so that's why nothing's going to change. No change is going to happen from a government, not any real change. And even European countries that are doing things like making far bigger emission cuts than the United States and getting ready to start banning fossil fueled cars from capital cities and countries, et cetera, et cetera. You know, those are nice gestures, but they're just token gestures, because a real response to the emergency that we're actually having would actually look something like immediate, full, globally government coordinated responses of, we have to stop all fossil fuel emissions ASAP and start punishing anybody who is not following that, you know, bylaw, and behaving accordingly. And that would only be an effort towards, again, being fully honest with population, saying, look, the genie's out of the bottle, and we're just going to see what we can do to mitigate it, because that's the moral thing to do, period. Not that it's going to stop anything, not that we're not still going headlong into disaster territory, because we are. But you know, that's what it should look like. And instead of that, what do we have? A media in the United States that I saw one report that in 2016, the entirety of the big television networks in the country spent under 1 hour total for the entire year combined reporting on climate change. And so, you know, again, status quo, just go back to sleep and keep buying stuff.
That is exactly true. And it is so bizarre that for anyone who's paying any attention at all, we know that this is the biggest issue unfolding on the planet. And why is it not the lead item every night on every mainstream news show? And my take on that is that in the last 50 years or 60 years, the whole planet has been taken over by the corporations. The whole narrative is controlled by the corporations, and all the corporations are interested in is business as usual. In World War II, in America, the American automotive industry was put in park, and all of their factories were used for, unfortunately, making weapons. But they went on that big plan of completely concentrating on the one issue of the day. But that's not happening. All that we're looking at now is business as usual, pedal to the metal, off the cliff, and no holding back.
And we all know about global dimming as well. I suspect most of the populace doesn't. And that's in part because well-paid climate scientists will essentially never raise the issue of global dimming. So even if we were to stop burning fossil fuels today as a result of the lack of global dimming, the planet would experience a very abrupt global average rise in temperature. So some people have called this the McPherson paradox. We keep burning fossil fuels to the metal, pedal to the metal, and that continues to heat the planet. Or we turn off the switch of industrial civilization that heats the planet even faster. So it seems damned if you do and damned if you don't, but nobody's talking about that.
I wouldn't mind betting what you've just referred to as the McPherson paradox is a reason why so many climate scientists and biologists won't speak out about the severity of the crisis. Everyone's seen what's happened to you. The minute you put your hand up and said, whoa, we're in serious trouble, you were shot down. You lost access to research grants and all of the things that are associated with it. And I would imagine a lot of scientists are thinking the same thing, that why would we go down the McPherson road when you can see how rocky and torturous it is? And perhaps, Star, that is a reflection with your industry, with the journalism, where journalists are a little bit reluctant to point the finger and say what a dire situation this is, because that's any positive effect on the share prices of those corporations you just discussed that now own the entire media?
Well, that's right. And there's also a really interesting phenomenon in journalism. Obviously, this is not only in journalism, but it's very prevalent in the media. There is a very big factor of groupthink happening. Like, for example, when I was working for Al Jazeera English over in Doha, and it's sometimes working down on the news floor where the TV anchor sat and gathering all of that information, that we, following the editors, we would be oftentimes waiting to report on a breaking story until another major media outlet took the leap, because we were too afraid to take the leap and go there because, oh, what if we ended up being wrong, or the story ended up being over sensationalized or something like this. So that's just one example, and that happened often. And it wasn't just Al Jazeera English that did that, but it's all of the media outlets to a certain extent are at least in some part implicated in that sort of a groupthink. Well, we're not going to report on that way, because then we would be the lone wolf and really going out on a limb. Nobody else is going to report on it. And I think that's a lot of what's happening with the climate disaster and people not reporting on it. But then there's also, of course, you know, the corporate funding behind media outlets, i.e. all of the major TV outlets in the United States are certainly under the same kind of pressure as the politicians, but in a slightly less obvious way. But that's certainly another factor in the equation. And then there's, you know, lastly, I would say there's, you know, the news as infotainment, that, you know, news outlets, and I'm talking about the major corporate outlets, they want to give people what people want instead of what's actually the news. And so the news is pretty consistently geared towards, well, you know, we don't want to do too many upsetting stories a day. We know that people really want Trump, so it's going to be all Trump all the time. That, you know, we don't want to waste our time talking about what's happening in the Arctic and other planetary emergencies. So that's another thing, is really soft peddling what media outlets even define as news to other to a population that they think really doesn't want to hear about it. And unfortunately, in a lot of instances, especially this one, they're usually right.
How spectacularly inverted is that? You would expect a news item, a news organization would jump at the opportunity to break a story. And what you've just described is they're doing the opposite. They want someone else to lead from the front. It's just completely inverted, like most of the things about industrial civilization.
Well, it exactly is that. And that's because it's not really journalism anymore, certainly not in the major outlets. It is literally backwards, because it used to be that, yeah, the big deal as a journalist is, can I break the really, really big story? And now media outlets are way more concerned with ratings and can they bring enough people in to watch to keep their corporate sponsors happy so that people watch the ads so that it pulls in more money. And it's that has become antithetical to breaking news stories, and vice versa. Breaking a big news story that's going to have dramatic implications, economic implications, as well as life implications, it's just not good for their business model. And that shows how absolutely antiquated and really out of whack that so-called business model is. We even have one for a media outlet that's supposedly tasked itself with bringing people factual information so that they can live their lives more intelligently.
Bravo.
You know, gentlemen, I don't want to dominate the show, so I'm going to sign off now. Thanks for the opportunity to chat a bit. Unless you say something that really trips my trigger, I won't be calling back in. Thank you both for what you're doing. You are courageous men, and I am honored to be associated with you at any time in any way. Be well.
Thank you very much, Guy. It was a pleasure to have you on the show for those few moments. Call in again anytime you like. Thank you. Dar, I'd like to go back to the Arctic for a moment, if I can. In your March 1st article on Truth Out, titled "Scientists Warn February Melting Near the North Pole Really Extreme," and I'll quote from it, "In another shocking development, Alaska's Bering Sea lost the full one-third of its ice in only 8 days. If this continues, it's hard for me to envisage us avoiding an ice-free Arctic sea this year, and the implications for that are terrifying." You did an article about Dr. Natalia Shukova and Igor Semilatov from the University of Fairbanks in Alaska, and their concerns about the methane emissions from the ESAS, the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. Could you give your opinion about where we are with regards to those issues?
Right. Well, I've written about this as well as I have a whole chapter on permafrost and methane in my forthcoming book. And what Shukova and several of her colleagues have been studying and writing multiple scientific studies on for quite a few years now is their concern about the methane trapped in the shallow seas of the Arctic, and particularly the Eastern Siberia shelf, where that's where the brunt of it is. And they're very concerned about the fact that as the summer sea ice is going away, it's exposing more and more of that area to direct sunlight and even warmer temperatures in the water. And so it's basically speeding up the thawing process of that subsea permafrost and releasing the methane. And so it is being documented now. There are increasing amounts of methane plumes around parts of the Arctic. And the only question is, do we get the 50 gigaton methane burp, as Shukova has warned us about, that could happen, as she said, essentially at any time? That we're already at a point where we've changed the system enough, from causing enough of the sea ice to melt and warming the water enough and warming the atmosphere enough, that literally this could happen any time. And that would be the equivalent of more than doubling a CO2 equivalent amount in the atmosphere than what humans have already emitted from since just the advent of the Industrial Revolution. And so that gives people an idea of how far along we already are and what the threat is. And then in addition to that, there are absolutely already multiple instances of these methane plumes, both subsea and on land. They're already increasing in number. It was just last summer, there were two more of these giant methane craters in Siberia that when these were reported by people living in the general vicinity, excuse me, they even reported seeing fire and smoke when these burst, unlike the other ones that they found these giant craters. Russian scientists went down to the bottoms and found high concentrations of methane. But this was the first time last summer that they were actually incendiary. And I've talked to some scientists about that, and there haven't been any papers released yet. People are still theorizing and trying to figure out what's happening beyond what they know, which is clearly these are giant vents of methane under pressure, then suddenly being released into the atmosphere, and there's craters with ejecta all around them. And so it's happening on land as well. And so this is a big deal because, as I think many of the listeners to this show are probably aware, that methane is a far more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. It's 100 times more potent on a 10-year time scale. So it doesn't take near as much methane to be released to cause dramatic impacts. And the amounts that are already being released and the amounts that certainly look inevitable to be released are worrisome, to put that mildly. And I think this is, with the sea ice going away rapidly at this point, as Guy just said, he thinks it's this year, whether it's this year or sometime in the next few years, when it goes away completely, that's when the methane situation becomes even that much more important, because it seems like what Chekhova is warning us about then becomes inevitable.
Are you aware of a New Scientist article and a Daily Telegraph article about a large trawler that was discovered in the Siberian Arctic, where it had dropped horizontally through a methane plume? And the boat had just been sailing along on the water. Then there was a massive discharge from the ocean below, so that the water column was just pushed away by the gas, and the trawler dropped horizontally like it would down a lift shaft, and it hit the bottom with no damage. It was just sitting there. When I post this show on my website with all the corroborating articles, I'll include that article for people to see how precarious the situation is. Jennifer Hines and I toured New Zealand in 2016, and Jennifer, on one of her slides, she had a slide of a pingo off the coast of New Zealand that was 6 kilometers in diameter. The discharge, obviously that, when it came out, it wouldn't have been that big, but the discharge crater was 6 kilometers in diameter. If you sailed into that, you're heading straight for Davy Jones's locker.
Yeah. And, these, again, that's just another iteration of the shock value of what's happening right in front of our eyes. When we talk about what we did at the top of the show about the Arctic, the North Pole, seeing above freezing temperatures at this time of year when the sun's not even up, to me, that has the same kind of shock value. I don't know how much more shocking really things can become. And that's a dangerous thing to say, because we all know that they're going to become far more shocking. But, each time one of these events occurs, like Hurricane Harvey sitting over Houston and dumping enough rain that NASA later reported that it literally pressed the Earth's crust down several millimeters because of the weight of the water was so much. That's how much water was there. And another statistic, just to kind of bring home to people, the freak nature of these events, that there was the equivalent of rain fell from Hurricane Harvey that was the equivalent of 1 million gallons for every Texan. And considering there's more than 30 million Texans, that's a lot of water. So again, you know, this is, you know, this is kind of sci-fi level things that we're seeing happen, and it's very alarming and it's very worrisome and it's scary, especially when you consider that, you know, for those of us unfortunate enough to be living in places that are right on the front lines, like people in Bangladesh, people down in South Florida living in the Keys, people living in these areas that in not so many years from now, they're literally not going to be there unless they choose to go back by boat. You know, these people understand it. They do not need any explanations. They are shocked that, you know, they're living in a place where they've had ancestors in a place like Bangladesh for thousands of years, and now they're going to have to leave. So, you know, they are alarmed and they do get it. Again, it's those of us in the privileged West that, you know, for right now anyway, there's somewhat of a buffer between being in that type of situation. But I think inevitably, all of us, it's going to be made so obvious by what's happening. So whether it's by wildfires or drought or economics, but, you know, all of us are going to be taking this on the chin, no matter what the level of denial is.
Unquestionably. There's a few things I'd like to point out about Harvey. When there was all that water in Texas, and as you said, it depressed on the land and flattened the land out or sunk it. When you have those big events like that, or when you drain an aquifer, you're either putting more weight or taking weight off the tectonic plates. And there is always the possibility that when you do that, you'll have more earthquakes. I think most people would concede that we're seeing more and more earthquakes as climate change progresses. And then with all that flood water that was in Texas floating around, sometimes submerging petrochemical works, there must have been an enormous amount of pollutants that were mixed in with that flood water, and that most of that or a lot of that would have drained out into the Gulf. So here we go, you know, the Gulf that you covered so well with our Deepwater Horizon and the pollution that it suffered. Here's another attack that people aren't really joining the dots for. And I think when we talk about our climate catastrophe that's unfolding, we have to join all the separate dots and not look at things in isolation. You know, this is the multiplicative effect that you get from tipping points and so many different things unfolding. A classic thing that happened during Harvey is that because of the technology that we have now, we can see these cyclones coming from quite a long way, or hurricanes in the Northern Hemisphere from quite a long way away. And we have a chance to prepare for them to some degree or other. But in Texas, the nuclear power stations kept generating new electricity. They didn't go into shutdown mode. They don't go into to prepare for the 135 mile an hour sustained winds that they had. And I looked into that and I found that one of the reasons why that they didn't go offline is they have contractual obligations to remain online. So there's a penalty fee for them whenever they go offline and aren't available to supply to the grid. So these people, for pure financial gain, they kept the nuclear power plants going while they had an extraordinary cyclone bearing down on them. This is the nature of the corporations. They are not going to do anything that affects their bottom line in the short term, because of course all this is short term thinking.
Right, and these are very important points. Another, I'll add to that. I actually was in Florida again recently, this time giving a talk, and just like when I went there May a year ago of 2017 to do research for my book on sea level rise, flying over Florida, over much of the state, and looking down from the plane, and the words of Dr. Harold Wanless, he's a sea level rise expert at University of Miami over in Coral Gables, and one of the few scientists that I've met with who is completely unafraid to tell the truth, because he warns, he thinks it's highly likely we'll see 10 feet of sea level rise by 2050, if not sooner, and that we could see 20 or even 30 feet by 2100, not even to talk about what happens after that, which is, of course, far worse. But one of the things that Dr. Wanless said that I hadn't thought of, which is one a point that you just mentioned, Kevin, is that if we had a government that was behaving responsibly, we would already be relocating everybody from South Florida, from the entire southern third of the state, and then even parts even further north than that. The government would be involved in buying back homes, relocating people, organizing all of that so that we don't have a mass exodus when the housing market collapses and everyone's trying to leave all at once, which we know is inevitable. And he said another thing that the part of that government intervention would require going in and doing environmental mitigation so that we don't leave these toxic waste sites underwater, whether it's fossil fuel refineries or nuclear plants, et cetera. Another thing to add to your point, Turkey Point nuclear plant just south of Miami, literally right on the coast, is not only are they not doing anything to relocate this plant or looking what's coming, but they're actually looking at right now as we speak, building two new reactors there. It's literally right on the coast. And again, this is just complete insanity where corporate profits are making all the decisions, that it's not to relinquish responsibility from the humans in control of these corporations and these energy sectors. They certainly needs to be held to account. But at the same time, this is where we see what's scary about this situation is corporate profits are literally what's making the decisions, that there's not humans involved. Because to give these people benefit of the doubt, assuming that many of them have families and have children and might have at least some concern about what might happen in the future, that their decision making is no longer even in the picture, where we've got such insanity that there's a nuclear power plant literally right on the coast of Florida, just south of Miami. And not only are they not talking about relocating it and having a responsible decommissioning and relocation and then mitigation of all the waste that's there, but they're going to add to its size. And when in reality, the entirety of South Florida, you know, a government should be going through, okay, where's all the waste? What are going to be toxic sites leaching things up into the ocean once all this is underwater in a few years from now? And not only is that not happening, but the economy's booming, the population's exploding, and everyone's just acting like everything's going to be great. And in reality, you know, you've got people like Dr. Hal Wanlis, who is portrayed by our culture, by the pop sector of our culture anyway, as sort of a Cassandra, as this kind of radical, you know, he's sounding these alarms, he's being dramatic, et cetera, when in reality, he's a paleoclimatologist who's been studying sea level rise the entirety of his more than 70 years of life. And I would hold his scientific resume up against anyone. And he's sitting here just scratching his head, wondering why governments won't be responsible and do things to take care of their citizens, let alone the planet.
It's as if they know that habitat is going away and extinction is going to happen before we will see any of these things. I think there's a distinct possibility that we will lose habitat on this planet before we see a meter of sea level rise. And these corporations aren't thinking that long way down the track. And I've got a theory about capitalism. I believe that capitalism is a vortex of sociopathy and psychopathy to the top. If you have a look at the people at the top of the corporations, I think a large number of them are suffering from one or other of those illnesses. And a characteristic of both those illnesses is a lack of empathy. So they don't go and have sleepless nights like we do, thinking about the consequences of what's coming and where we're going. Seeing as though we're on the nuclear issue and we're 4 days away from the 7th anniversary of Fukushima Daiichi in Japan, I've been an anti-nuclear activist for 40 years, since I was a teenager. And on April the 26th, 1986, my worst fears unfolded on the nuclear scene when Chernobyl blew up. I was in Istanbul at the time, and I got irradiated then. And then, of course, 7 years ago, this week, Fukushima Daiichi happened. The tsunami took out the three plants, it overflowed the very small seawall that they had. And TEPCO had paid for studies to identify how big a tsunami, possible tsunami, could be that could attack the plant. And they ignored their own scientific analysis on how big a tsunami could be. They made a smaller seawall to save money. And now we've had ionizing radiation bleeding into the ocean for all that time, for 2,500 days. But a little discussed aspect of it is the radionuclides that are going into the atmosphere from three exposed coriums that are somewhere underneath the plant. But, you know, they're out of containment, so they're definitely emanating ionizing radiation into the atmosphere. What's your take on how bad Fukushima Daiichi is relative to any other industrial disaster?
I reported really heavily on this story when I was working for Al Jazeera English over in Doha. And one of the first stories I did on it, interviewing several Japanese nuclear experts, as well as a couple of people back here in the United States who are being very outspoken and critical about government's handling of the crisis. And the story I wrote shortly after the disaster occurred was called Fukushima, It's Much Worse Than You Think. And it went on to become the most read story of the year for Al Jazeera English. And it became popular enough that I actually got invited to the Japanese embassy in Doha to go have lunch with the Japanese ambassador to Qatar. And so that was a very interesting conversation. Of course, I did not stop my reporting after that free lunch at the embassy, I'd like to point out. Again, it's like we could put it in the grouping with the climate crisis, where here's this massive story, global implications for every human's health on the planet, and it's been completely swept under the rug. I mean, even more so than the climate crisis. But I think I would argue that it's the single worst industrial accident thus far in human history, far surpassing Chernobyl as far as the amount of radiation that's been released and is being released. And the fact is that they do not have a solution to this crisis. I mean, I've interviewed Arne Gundersen here, you know, a nuclear expert of decades, an engineer and a scientist. And he said, look, the technology does not exist for them to go in and deal with these molten cores. There is not a solution to this crisis. And meanwhile, the Japanese government is busy planning for the Tokyo Olympics. And guess where the surfing is currently slated to take place? Fukushima Prefecture. You can't make this stuff up. That's the amount of, I wouldn't call it willful denial. I would call it criminal negligence that countries' governments are going to not just cover up the crisis, but, you know, again, doing it for the almighty economy we can't really sound the alarm on this because then Japan might not get the Summer Olympics or they'd have to be relocated. And we can't do that because then that would tip off the rest of the world to this massive, massive festering crisis that's happening in our country that we just don't have a solution for. And OPS, that means maybe nuclear power is not a good idea.
You mentioned the criminality of the situation. And I mentioned earlier the fact that TEPCO knew that the seawall should be higher, and to save money, they built another one. And now the entire biosphere will be punished forever as a result of that decision. No one, not one single soul, has gone to jail for what happened at Fukushima Daiichi. The corporation that caused the disaster is still running the cleanup campaign. They are tapping the Japanese taxpayers for billions and billions of dollars with no accountability. They have this ridiculous ice wall that they have built between the plant and the ocean, which consumes an extraordinary amount of energy to keep it cool, and it's not working. All that was just some bizarre proposition that someone who was linked to TEPCO got through, and they built this thing that will not work, does not work, and will never work. TEPCO keep telling us that it's going to take them something like 40 years to solve this problem. Excuse me, if you don't know how you're going to solve a problem, you can't put a timeline limit on how long that's going to take. So I believe that every time TEPCO speaks and they publish anything or make any statement, they're lying to us. They're always downplaying the severity of the crisis.
Well, without a doubt. And again, it's you know, what aspect of the problem do we want to talk about? Because it's always – it's the same thing. I mean, it's supplant Fukushima Daiichi with the climate crisis, and it's the exact same thing. And this is why people won't talk about it. And it actually, Dr. Harold Wanless, who I spoke of just a short while ago, he actually has been very outspoken in calling out these so-called political leaders, calling them criminally negligent, that there literally will be blood on their hands of people that when, for example, the housing crisis, the bottom falls out of the housing market in places like Miami and Miami Beach and other areas around South Florida, and everyone's trying to sell their house at once. And, you know, and actually there's actually been a business report showing that that will happen before the first house is inundated with seawater, that once this economic tipping point is reached and people get, oh, it's happening and it's inevitable, and the last person to sell their house loses, and everyone's, you know, it's like running to Walmart on Black Friday in the United States. People are like pummeling themselves to get the most, you know, the best deal on a TV, but with who can sell their house the fastest. And then there's no more economy. And then, of course, there's no more tax dollars to deal with mitigating toxic sites or decommissioning a nuclear plant in Turkey Point because it's OPS, it's going to be underwater. Again, it truly is criminal negligence. And this is not being alarmist. This is simply surveying the situation, looking at the reality that is now upon us, whether it's Turkey Point or Fukushima Daiichi or the entire planetary climate crisis, and look at the political leaders' reaction to them. And, you know, if huge numbers of people weren't going to die as a result, it would be laughable. You know, it would be like Keystone Cops kind of stuff. But in reality, it is criminal negligence because a lot of people are going to die. And it's, you know, the bottom economically is going to fall out because inevitably all of this will come out, you know, whether it's forced by the planet or things worsening at Fukushima where they can no longer continue to deny it. But all of this is going to come out, and at which point, you know, a lot of these leaders, you know, then it's game over for them too. But, you know, I keep scratching my head and wonder when this is going to happen, because the evidence is right before us, and yet the system keeps trundling on, you know, one more day, one more day, one more day. But inevitably, that's why, you know, I've reached a point in my own work where we have to counterbalance this work and paying attention to what's going on and reporting about it and talking about it with large doses of just going and being with the parts of the planet that are still functioning. And so for me, I go into the mountains every week, and certainly in the summer when it's accessible, I go up with these glaciers, and oftentimes we'll just go and just sit with them, you know, and just be with them, because I know that in my lifetime, easily, they will be gone. You know, I mean, I went out with the lead glaciologist at Glacier National Park over in Montana here, Dan Fagry, with a U.S. Geological Survey, and he made international media news last summer when I was over there talking with him, when he said there'll be no more active glaciers in Glacier National Park by 2030. And that's his most conservative estimate, you know, 2030. So 12 years, that park's going to need a new name, you know, or at least, you know, the park formerly known as Glacier National Park, however they're going to deal with that. But he said, no, by our own definitions of what qualifies as a glacier, by the area of ice that is there and the fact that it has to be moving, that by those criteria, there will not be a functional glacier in Glacier National Park by 2030. And he said there will not be functional glaciers just about anywhere on the planet that are land terminating glaciers by 2100. He said that too, you know, and he's scratching his head and saying, yeah, I've had to become battle hardened as I go out and I watch this thing that I've loved my whole life and study, I'm watching it go away, you know? And so he talked a little bit about PTSD as a scientist and dealing with that. And he's another one of the few scientists that's been very outspoken, unafraid to talk about this in the media and tell the truth about what's happening. And it made a very, very big splash when he did it. And so I just want to acknowledge that there are some really, really good scientists out there, very aware of what's happening and unafraid to talk about it and tell the truth, regardless of what the consequences might be, whether it's risking funding or being blackballed within their own community by their colleagues or things like this. So it's important to acknowledge that. And then I just do want to remind people that wherever you live, there's a part of nature, even if you're in the city, not that far from you, that's still functional, whether it's a forest or a river or mountains or glaciers. And it's just really remind people that it is an urgent time to go out and spend time with the planet, because we're watching a lot of these things go away before our very eyes. And so it's important for us, and I think the planet as well, that we keep bringing our hearts out there to it and spending time with it.
I concur 100%. I have two wonderful friends on Rakino Island, Stephen and Stacey Thomas, who have started a not-for-profit nursery called the Rakino Island Nursery. And I volunteer down there propagating native plants for a rewilding project that we have on the island. I believe the biosphere will collapse very, very quickly, and I'm still going to be planting trees. I would love to be the last sapien on the planet to put a seed in the ground, and I'll happily be that person. But I think one of the things you alluded to is the grief that we're all suffering as we study this, and it can be a little bit either intoxicating or you get a fix on having to get up and look and find out what the latest information, because there's a tsunami of information coming in from every direction. I interviewed Professor Paul Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb, and he's a biologist, and he wrote a recent paper with a biological annihilation in the title, and it was about the collapse of flying insect populations in Europe, in Germany specifically, in their national parks. The same thing is happening in Australia. There's been articles written about it recently where people are seeing the same thing. I've got anecdotal studies that I've done in New Zealand of driving at night through areas, country areas, where when I was a child, the car would be completely bug splattered, and now there's hardly an insect on it. I think we have to, I'd really like our listeners to get their head around tipping points and the multiplicative effect of all these things. If you have a look around, there is chaos breaking out in all sorts of different fields. A lot of it not even particularly related to climate change. The fall of estimation of the flying insect populations is probably more related to us bathing the planet in herbicides and insecticides rather than as much as climate change, but climate change is a multiplier on that. I'd like to talk to one more issue as we're sort of drawing down to a close to the end of the show, is the ecological consequences of imperialist wars and the carbon footprint of the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex and the non-aligned nations who have to ramp up their own defences in anticipation of that imperialist threat. One of the accusations that's lodged against me when I talk about extinction and how late in the day we are is that people say, oh, yeah, but if people listen to you, Hester, they won't do their own things. You know, they won't try and lower their own carbon footprint. Well, I won't accept that. I believe it's a complete straw man argument. I see the reality is that nothing that even I believe we should be doing all of those things and lowering our carbon footprint. Nothing we do as individuals is going to mitigate the fact that the corporations and the military-industrial complex have this raging buildup of munitions and armaments and warmongering around the planet that it completely dwarfs anything that individuals on their own can do. How do you see that situation?
I completely agree with those facts, and then add, but And people ask me what I just talk about what I do when I give my talks now. And, you know, I don't pretend to tell anybody what to do because I don't know what anybody else should do at this point in the crisis. So I just share what I do. And I say, yes, despite all these facts that our backs are against the wall, that all of this is now upon us and we know what's coming and it's going, today is better than tomorrow for the climate, right? That it's only going to keep getting worse. But I have a solar powered house. I work actively, regularly to lower my carbon footprint. I grow my own food. I'm about to increase that food production rather dramatically. I live on my land with people that are trying to do the same thing and live their lives in the same way because it's the moral thing to do. You know, like I, you know, people say, well, you know, if we're totally screwed, why not just go have like the mother of all parties? It's like, well, that's not how I want to go out. I want to go out on my feet with my own dignity and because it's the moral thing to do and because it's still the right thing to do for the planet. And so these few acres where I live surrounded by a bunch of beautiful trees in the Pacific Northwest, I am going to spend my days trying to take care of this little piece of the planet because it's the right thing to do, period.
I am exactly on the same path as you. There was a recent interview you did where you talked about being able to look young people in the eye and what you did while we were watching this unfold. And I firmly believe in doing that as well, but I'm not going to bullshit young people and say you can fix this or it's your job to fix this. That is so cruel and unfair to young people. We've only got 1 minute now to go. Adar, I'd just like to wind up with your latest book. When will The End of Ice be coming out?
It is currently slated to be released to the public in January of next year. So we're still about 9 months away. I'm editing it right now, and I'm very excited about it, as is my publisher, The New Press. But it will be available in January, give or take a month. So thanks for bringing that up. It's called The End of Ice, and it's going to be I feel confident that it's my best book yet.
Let's hope it hits the bookstores before collapse unfolds. Brother, I'd love you to come back to New Zealand sometime soon before all that shit goes down. And I'd like to thank Afra Zen for his theme music for the show, which the studio will play for you now. Thank you very much, everybody, for your time. Have a great extinction.
She's gonna get you.